Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how high levels of exercise are linked to a 9 years expanded aging. That's right, from Brigham Young University. So that's a big, big plus. And also we're going to look at the Tai Chi, the meditation exercise, how it can relieve insomnia in breast cancer survivors, University of California at Los Angeles, and how vitamin D and calcium from food can help lower the risk of menopause, University of Massachusetts, and how the omega-3 can help with prenatal depression. That's a big deal. And that's from the Gung University of Medicine in Taiwan. And also, yogurt in oldish Irish adults was linked with better bone health from Trinity College Dublin. Also today, I have a guest in the second part of our program. That guest is Bill Snapp, and he is a senior counselor for the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're going to talk about Donald Trump's assault on the environment and our ecology. He is really knowledgeable. Also later today, I don't know what time, I'm expecting a call in from Syria, and we have someone on the ground there who is going to break a news story. It'll be an exclusive story. Because we won't be on the air at that time, I'll put it on the top of the show for tomorrow. So hopefully, if we're able to make the connections, we'll have something new and relevant that no other media in America has that we'll have exclusively tomorrow. Also, our audio clip file today, we're going to show from Arne Gunderson taking a call from a listener on a radio show, or I guess, we don't know the environment, but he brings up something about Fukushima that no one knew about, brand new information. And then there was Malcolm X speaking about Muhammad Ali and the systematic destruction of the black male image. Short piece, but I thought very relevant. And Jill Stein, who was attacked, I thought, in a very demeaning, mean-spirited way by Bill Maher. Well, that shouldn't surprise anyone. Bill is the darling of the left, but I don't find his humor funny. I don't find his Islamophobia interesting and his misogyny acceptable. So now he's attacked Jill Stein, said some very egregious comments about her. So Jill Stein will have a response. Also, time permitting, I'm not sure it will, but if it does, we'll put it on a short TED Talk, only 4 minutes, about war and weapons in the global conflict. Also today, I'm going to have a brief period where I'm going to ask you to call in and give your comments about something, and I'll share that with you shortly when we talk about teaching and what people are learning and are we really aligned correctly. Starting off, from our public health segment, antibiotics unnecessarily prescribed for half, that's 50% of all seniors with colds. This is from UPI Health News. It says research shows nearly 1 in 2 seniors, this was in Ontario, Canada, were prescribed antibiotics when they visited their doctor for common cold symptoms. The new study from the Institute of Clinical Evaluation of Sciences showed this. Now, here's why this is important, because antibiotics don't work for colds or the flu. These are mainly from viruses. Over 100 different viruses can participate, and of course, a weakened immune system. So when you are giving someone an antibiotic, that's for bacteria. And then it has to be specific for the type of bacteria to work. Now, what will happen in those people who are manifesting any form of symptoms of cold, You will then take the bacteria and you will kill off the good bacteria in the biome, and you'll multiply the bad bacteria. Now you're setting up a milieu in the intestine that will not help the person get well. So not only is it not constructive, but it's also destructive for the biochemistry of the person. So if you have a cold, there's no purpose in taking antibiotics. It will not help you. And we're not told that, and we should. As many of you know, in 2 weeks, Sunday, not this Sunday, but Sunday week at 7 p.m., I'll be doing this year my third webinar. Now, the first two have been extremely successful, and they're up online if you didn't attend them, and one was on how to survive any disaster. The new one is about aging, and it's going to be very broad-based. First, we start with a movie on aging you haven't seen, a new documentary. And then I talk probably for an hour and a half to 2 hours about aging in the brain, aging in your musculatures, your skin, your eyes. And then I go into specific areas like menopause and how we can reverse menopause. And we've actually done it. In fact, in the only study that's in the scientific literature, I can find a multidisciplinary approach, non-medical, no synthetic hormone replacement therapy. In a group of over 288 women who finished this study, we were able to reverse virtually every symptom of menopause, from thinning of the skin and mucous membranes and multiple infections, mood swings, weight gain without overeating, thinning of the hair, loss of libido, all these other things that happened, slowing down of the thyroid, all were reversed. And I published a study, I presented it at a scientific conference, so I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, memory loss, depression, the things that go in our brain because we're not aware of what happens when our brain chemistry goes out of balance. And it will go out of balance. It does go out of balance based upon what we provide our body. So anyhow, when I'm talking about how to slow down and reverse the aging process, there are two things we absolutely positively know scientifically will work. We can extend the telomeres and we can repair the DNA. And by doing those two things, we can, in effect, really slow down aging. We can reverse aging. Exercise and fasting or caloric restriction are two ways we can accomplish that. Now, I'm going to go into greater depth on that at that time. Here's the latest research from Brigham Young University. New research shows a major advantage for those who are highly active. Quote, research at Brigham Young University reveals you may be able to slow one type of aging, the kind that happens inside your cells, as long as you're willing to sweat. Quote, just because you're 40 doesn't mean you're 40 years old biologically. We all know people seem younger than their actual age. The more physical active that we are, the less biological aging takes place in our bodies. The study published in the medical journal Preventive Medicine finds that people who have consistently high levels of physical activity have significantly longer telomeres than those who have sedentary lifestyles, as well as those who are moderately active. Telomeres, the people in this audience certainly know already, they're the protein end caps of our chromosomes. They're like our biological clock, and they're extremely correlated with age. Each time a cell replicates, we lose a tiny bit of the end caps. Therefore, the older we get, the shorter our telomeres. Well, exercise, in this case, is able to have an impact upon telomeres and biological aging. So it's huge. 9 years for those of you who exercise at least 30 minutes a day, 40 minutes for men, 5 days a week. So I want to go back and look at the Natural Living Running and Walking Club. We started it back in 1977. So here we have a club, one of the oldest clubs, one of the five oldest clubs out of 120 clubs in the New York area for runners and walkers. And for Peter Roth and all the ones who were there over the decades as coaches, Dolores Perry and Sam Skinner, for all the athletes that started with us, some of the greatest athletes on the planet today, still active, Sid Howard, for example, Thelma Wilson, Louise Nottage, one of the greatest athletes in American history. In fact, I don't remember her ever losing a race. She was just an average person when she started with us. And Thelma Wilson's one of the greatest senior athletes in the world today. Over 30,000 people we got exercising, but we did it holistically, naturally, meaning we knew that it was a stress upon our immune system due to long-distance training, but we compensated. Vegan diet, lots of supplements, lots of juices, meditation. And as a result, we got stronger, healthier. Now look at this study showing that those who did this kind of exercise, you've added 9 years onto your lifespan. Now the fact that we don't believe in excessive caloric consumption, meaning eating what your body actually needs, add another 5 years on. So you've just gained 14 years onto your lifespan. My mother told me once, long ago, she said, you won't know now whether or not you're making right choices. But there will be a time when you'll turn around, you look behind you, when you reach some destination, and you ask yourself, here I am. Is this where I thought I was going to be? Is this where I want to be? And is this where I should be? And when we are exercising every day, even if our friends and family are not, when we're taking the time to have our juices, our lemon juice and apple cider vinegar and things other people would throw up trying to have, but we're having them, when we're out there, no matter what the weather, and we're doing it, and when we're taking our time to bypass all the junk foods and to have only healthy foods and to take our supplements and to be mindful in our meditations, then one day we wake up and we're 40. Our friends are 40. We look 30. They look 60. And they act 70. And the older you get, the more apparent this is. So just imagine how many of you now, because over the last 40 years, you've been training at different times, and the average length of the time, I did this about 2 weeks ago. I was traveling, filming. I'm out now. I'll be back in a couple weeks. And when I'm traveling, I do my writing. I like to write longhand. And I also think about things. And I was thinking about how many people raced. And I was remembering a guy named Frank Gallo and a whole bunch of really neat people. And we would run together on a Sunday morning in Central Park. And we would zip around the park. We would go out at like a 5:27 pace. And we would be maybe 60 of us in a pack. And we would train hard. And we would race. Every single race we did, we won. People in that race won. Marathons and shorter races. And the average time the person trained with us and raced with us was about 7 years. And they did an average of 5 marathons. So I look back very fondly at all the people that have been out there. So when I come back this couple weeks, I'm going to start getting people ready to do the next New York City Marathon. We're going to do it. I'm going to do it with you. I'm not racing it now. I'll race next year in the World Games. I'll train for that. But I'll do the marathon with those who just want to do it for fun, because we do it for fun. It's just a party for us because we train right. And now you look back and think, wow, those were all good choices. When everybody else was mocking healthy food and saying, oh, you're a health nut, better than being a sick nut. And we were exercising, keeping ourselves strong and lean and cut. And they were getting bellies and fat, and they were kind of angry or jealous that they weren't out there doing it. So instead of complimenting you, they put you down. Now turn around. We know the value of our choices when we reach our destination. The destination is better health, younger, biologically, and more fit. So that's a message for everyone. So get off your dead asses and exercise. And don't give yourself an excuse for anything. There was a paraplegic guy that was hurt in Afghanistan, and he made a little home video. He was all mangled. He's in a wheelchair. And then you saw this man fall out of his wheelchair, get on the floor, try to stretch his body, and you could tell it was painful, and you could tell it was hard. Well, I think it was about a year and a half later, this guy is doing yoga. He is running. He's completely back. Such a motivation, such an inspiration. And I want to see more of that. People getting up and saying, I'm not limited because society says I have to be. My doctor says I can't get over this. Sure you can. And it starts by getting out there and walking. Just walk. And then increase your walking in distance, and then increase your time and pace. And then with endurance and strength and stamina, suddenly your blood sugar is normal, your blood pressure is more normal, your digestion is increased, your liver is functioning better, your kidneys are eliminating better, your intestines are working more smoothly, your lungs are healthier, your heart rate is down, all to the good. And also, Tai Chi is very important. It's a simple exercise. It's a meditative exercise. But this latest study from the University of California shows that it helps women who are breast cancer survivors. So it relieves insomnia. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. So do your Tai Chi. And vitamin D and calcium can lower early menopause risk. This University of Massachusetts, a new study led by epidemiologists at the university, Amherst School of Public Health and Health Sciences, suggests that a high intake of dietary calcium and vitamin D, I'm going to say 1,000 milligrams of calcium citrate, I'm going to say 5,000 units of vitamin D, can have an association with lowering the risk of early menopause, which is the cessation of ovarian function, generally before the age of 45. And early menopause affects almost 10% of women, and also it increases a woman's risk of cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, cognitive decline, and stroke. So it's not an advantage of having an early menopause. It's a disadvantage. So get your calcium, get your vitamin D, and take them together. And finally, omega-3, that's the good fatty acids, can help with prenatal depression. That's according to the latest study from Chang'an University College of Medicine in Taiwan. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest in health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. If you would like to know what we have coming, we have Donald Trump's assault on the environment and our ecology with my guest, Bill Snapp from Washington, D.C. He is the senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity, a national organization dedicated to the preservation of the biodiversity of wildlife and flora, which is hovering on the brink of extinction, and the environmental protection of lands and waters and climate necessary for survival of species. That's coming up. Now, a couple issues that I thought were interconnected and hence important. First, there's a new study that most people are not aware of. I'll share something from Daniela Paquette from the Washington Post. Quote, nearly a third of business leaders and technology analysts express no confidence that education and job training in the United States will evolve rapidly enough to match the next decade's labor market demands, a new report from the Pew Research Center finds. About 30% of the executives, hiring managers, college professors, and automation researchers who responded to the Pew survey felt future prospects looked bleak, anticipating that firms would encounter more trouble finding workers with their desired skill sets over the next decade. Quote, barring a neuroscience advance that enables us to embed knowledge and skills directly into the brain tissue and muscle formation, there will be no quantum leap in our ability to upscale and upskill people, says the person. Seriously, you're asking about the workforce of the future as if there's going to be one. Whoa. All right. And the Pew Director of Internet Science and Technology Research, the study's co-author, helped canvas 8,000 leading decision makers in Pew's database. And they just, here's what they said. They said, brace yourself, quote, for machines that transform the ways humans work, sometimes in unpredictable ways. And, quote, people are wrestling with this basic metaphysical question, what are humans good for? It's important to figure that out because this blended world of machines and humans is already upon us, and it's going to accelerate. Now, here's my take on this. I believe that we are, in the United States, in most but not all institutions, and with many but not all professors, we are behind the learning curve. We have several things happening simultaneously. For example, if you paid attention to what the president's son-in-law is doing in his firm, they were in China this week and employing people, give us $500,000 and you can get a special visa, in effect, to work in the United States. Plus, your investment will go into some housing project. I managed to get the audio recording of the major law firm that recruits these visa workers from around the world. And he was talking to other employers about why it's good. A, you're getting very highly skilled people, generally people with PhDs, where the average American worker may not only have just a regular BA or BS, maybe a master's degree, but not a PhD. The American worker has seniority. Hence, they're going to have greater benefits, greater cost to the company, greater number of days off, sick pay, etc. These people come in, you don't have to give them anything. And you give them, they generally will work for half to two-thirds off what you're paying. Huge savings in pay to the people that are most expensive in your company. Upper management, upper middle management, and technical people. These people are much more skilled because they grew up with the idea you've got to learn and there was discipline. So that's the pitch they're making. Now, there are tens of thousands, over 80,000 of these people per year coming in the United States and more. They're taking the place of people who had good jobs, nice lifestyle and living conditions. Well, what are those people supposed to do now? Now, that's at one end. At another end, are college students going to college? Because we're all taught, go to college. And there was a time when I would agree, go to college. You have much more advantage when you go to college and get a degree in a specific field that you know that there's going to be employment. That's just common sense. However, that's the old value. The new value is, don't go to college unless you first can determine, are you going there for a specific reason? If you're going just to do a liberal arts undergraduate and then find out what you want to do, you're just wasting time. If your parents are rich and they can pay for this and you don't have to worry about student debt, you don't have to worry about being employed, you can live at home and be comfortable and play on your computer all day, that's fine. Then waste your time. It is my personal opinion as a college educator, having taught in college, the New School, the College New Rochelle, Fairleigh Dickinson University, and Pratt Institute, and other schools in the New York area, that the days when people came to learn, to help themselves, better themselves in the workplace, that's not why most people go to school today. And so if you're the average person and you think, I got to get that education or I'm not going to be able to compete, you better think about what it means to compete. There are times in life where having no debt but not having the advantage of a degree that you cannot in any way use to your advantage is actually more beneficial than having the debt that you must pay or someone's going to pay it. 80,000 graduates now are defaulting on their payment. Do they steal the money? Yes. Can they be arrested? Yes. Is there compounding interest still going on even if they don't pay it for a year, 10 years? Yes. Will it double or triple the amount they actually owe? Yes. Will they ever get out of debt peonage? Probably not. So what good was that degree? What good was that education? So we have to rethink. So if you are specific in what you want to do, if you've done detailed homework and you see that there's great opportunity in the field that you're educated in, then take your chances. Otherwise, better look to where there actually is work. And what this study is showing is robotics, or this whole new form of intelligent robot, is going to be taking millions of jobs out of the workplace. So we're not only going to get hit with an upcoming recession that will dwarf the one that we had in 2007 and 8, because we're living in a fantasy when it comes to thinking that we have the stock market at 21,000, equity is high. In some companies, yes, they're very profitable, they're liquid, they're solid. But most companies have high debt. How much debt? Corporate debt is the Achilles heel of the entire business community. Just since 2010, in the last 7 years, they've taken on $7.6 trillion in debt. $7.6 trillion. Add on to what was before 2010, and I believe you're up around $25 trillion in debt. That's a huge amount. That's more debt that American corporations have than our entire gross domestic product. So, we're going to see more closing of retail outlets, all these box stores. We're going to see more jobs outsourced, not in the United States. We're going to see more robotics taken over, and we're going to see more educated people coming in under visas to take the jobs of people who thought they were secure and could make it through. We're going to see more debt and debt peonage and debt prisons and debt arrests, because we don't have an administration willing to forgive debt, this one or the last one. If we were enlightened at all and cared about citizens, we would give free tuition at public institutions. Private institutions, that's their business. They can charge and you can pay if you feel that you're getting a better education. You're not. But if you want to live with that game of illusion, going to Harvard instead of some other school because you think that it's going to help you, it won't. But keep that game going. So now you got robotics, you got visas, you got a recession, and you have corporations with trillions of dollars in debt. And the moment people don't have the expendable money and stop buying things that those corporations manufacture or offer services, then those companies are going to go under because they cannot service their debt. Over 12% of all American corporations today cannot service the financing charges on their debt, meaning they can't even pay the interest. So they're not showing you that, because if all of corporate America showed you how insolvent they are, how bankrupt they are, then why would you want a career in a field where there's going to be big shakeout? The biggest single career in the future will be in service industries. The service industries are people that, you know, restaurants, you know, box stores, and bartenders, things that will not align with your college education or the ability to pay it back or to have a standard of living or quality of life. Hard message to take, you bet. A necessary one to hear, yes. Trade schools, I think, will be far more important, at least those trades that are continuing. Remember, we don't have one economy. We have seven economies. So it depends upon which economy you're in as to what your future will be and what your opportunities are and how you should gear yourself. I'm speaking now not of the rich, the super rich, the 8 million millionaires and their family members. I'm not even talking about the professional class, lawyers, engineers, accountants, CPAs, professors. I'm talking about the working class persons. Those are the ones who are going to be affected. So it may be a time, instead of taking a college, realize you have an advantage to learn from life, put your energy on your health, your happiness, your spiritual values, go out and look at the world, see your communities, and from your own personal visits and your own research, where are the best places to live and how can you get there? That lends me to go into this other area of another story. Quote, this is from Elena Strauss from The Atlantic. The hot new millennial housing trend is a repeat of the Middle Ages. For most of human history, people were hunter-gatherers. They lived in large camps, depending upon one another for food, child care, and everything else, all without walls, doors, or picket fences. In comparison, the number of people living in most households in today's developed countries is quite small. According to the Census Bureau, fewer than 3 people live in the average American household, and the number of members of most American households can be counted on one hand or even increasingly one finger. Single-person households only made up 13% of all American households in 1960. Now it's 28%, meaning 28% of all American homes have just one person living there. So belonging to a relatively small household has become a norm, even though it can make daily life more difficult in many ways. Privacy may be nice, but cooking and doing chores become much less time-consuming when shared with an additional person or even several people. Water, electric, and internet bills also become more bearable when divided among multiple residents. There are social downsides to living alone, too. Many elderly people and young professionals and stay-at-home parents and single people routinely spend long stretches of time at home alone. No matter how lonely they may feel, more distressingly, many single parents face the catch-22 of working and paying for childcare. Living in smaller numbers can be a drain on money, time, and feelings of community, and the rise of the two-parent dual-earning household only compounds the problems of being time poor. It wasn't always like this. Living arrangements have been changing for thousands of years, and the concept of the nuclear family originated relatively recently. Even as the economy has moved away from the sort of agricultural labor that would encourage large households, people still have just as much of a need for the support of friends, family, and neighbors. Perhaps that is why so many people today, from young coders to lonely elderly to families, are experimenting with communal living, a way of life that, whether they know it or not, echoes how things work for most of human history. And it goes on from there. Here's my thoughts. I actually disagree with this. I disagree on many levels. I believe that, yes, it is not healthy for most people to live alone. You need interactions with people. Just look at all the suburbs. And this is one of the phenomena I saw in the 7 years I was out researching and filming Poverty Inc. I saw that there might be 4,000 homes in just one compound out near Las Vegas, one neighborhood. And yet one of the highest rates of foreclosures in America occurred there. So when I'm talking with people, did you know your neighbor? Well, we knew the neighbor, you know. But what happened did you know they were getting foreclosed on? No, we didn't know that. Nobody helped anyone. They would look through their blinds at their neighbor, you know, being out on the lawn and all the things happening, and then their neighbor's gone. That whole sense that people were living in a community, yet they weren't involved in community. They weren't really friends. They were just sharing common areas. And especially true in New York City, where you can go up every day in a building with people that you've been in the same building for 20 years and you never have a word outside of hi and goodbye in the elevators. We have intentionally separated ourselves. People need to relate to one another. People need the communion of human relationship. We need to be able to have a meal together, to go for a walk together, to do things together. This whole idea that this is mine, it's not yours, stay off my grass, here's my fence, here's where I live, you don't live here, stay away. We've gotten so preoccupied with the idea that something is ours without realizing everything in life has an expiration date. Everything that you value, everyone that you appreciate, you will lose in your lifetime. Or others will lose you in theirs. Everything is transient. So what I see is not the commune, and here's why I'm against communes, because I've seen them. I've traveled to them. I was very tempted at different times to convert my old Fertiller farm upstate New York, which was the first organic farm, certified farm in New York State, the first food co-op, the High Falls Food Co-op. Started that back in 1972. The first vegan restaurant, the Fertile Earth, up on 108th and Broadway. So I was involved with having people come up and hang out, and especially artists and anti-war activists, and it was a wonderful time. But then someone has to pay for everything. Who pays for the electricity? Who grows the food? Who cooks the food? What if you have people who have different ideas, not just political ideas, where you can keep your own ideas separate and share what you have in common, but the moment you have strangers living in a common environment, you're going to have conflict. And if the purpose of living with other people is to live in harmony and live at the high end of your spiritual, emotional, and creative values, then you better know the people before you move into a place with them. There's also generational issues. Younger people have different values than older people. People are single than people who have families. Kids are always an issue. Some people love kids. Other people don't like noise and kids. And so once you get into these communes and you start talking with people, you see, yeah, well, we were there for a while and we just couldn't handle it anymore. You know, my husband's very neat and so many other people there were very sloppy, and some people would work and help and other people would always show up deep but would never clean up and never... You have all these interpersonal conflicts. So that's why I don't support communes. Echo villages, they're fine as far as living in a place where you really don't know many people, but you just know that you're all using solar or you're all using wind. But outside of that common denominator, that doesn't transverse the boundaries we need to relate with people as human beings. It's just objectification. We're all into solar. Fine, what else? What I think is necessary for the future, especially for the younger people, is what I would call quality of life living. Meaning, first and foremost, create your own website about your ideals of what you would like to do, where you would like to live, and the kind of activities and people you'd like to associate with. And then through a process of personal meeting, have meetings with people so people can share their ideas so you get to know people. You don't want people bringing their dysfunction. You don't want people bringing their anger, their rage, their resentments, their biases, because that becomes the only asset that you're going to remember from those people. Negative, toxic, dysfunctional people make a mess of everything they touch. And they're very good at disguising it, but intuition tells you, do you want to be around this person or not? So it may take you a little bit of time to find the people you'd like to be associated with, then find the places. There are wonderful communities all across this country. Now, these are communities, meaning people have their own homes or lodging, and they can have visitors stay. You pay some small fee or you're engaged in fair exchange. You can paint, so you do some painting in return. You get to live free. You know, there's all kinds of exchanges. And at the end of the day, if you want to move on, you do. If it doesn't harmonize with you, fine. But if it does, you stay and you enjoy that. I see those types of communities being the future. And there are a lot of young people who can bring their talents and learn and be a part of those communities in the future. I think that would be very healthy and very positive, because a lot of those younger people have faced the world and many of its limitations, but they haven't gone out there to, in effect, measure their own capacities of growth. And when you're in an environment around nature, when you're in a sustainable environment, when you're around a mixture of younger and older people, so you gain the knowledge and wisdom of older people, when you're around people of all walks of life, you gain other skills and appreciation for what other people can do, it inspires you to do more for yourself. The key is you gotta be with the right people. That's the key. So take your time. And it's like French cooking, reductionism. Reduce down the people you don't want to be with to the people you do. And in my world, that would be no hassle people. Don't bring your drama to my smiling face, because then I'm going to have to work on your drama, and I don't want to do that. It's not my responsibility. But people are great at having other people try to rescue them. We have a nation. It's an obsession pandemic. It is a massive tsunami of dysfunction at the emotional level in the American family system, single or married, young or old, where people just hang on expecting someone else through some form of warp entitlement to rescue them from themselves. Of course, they never do make the change, so it's just a waste of time and energy. Get with people that got their act together. Where is it written that you cannot, you're going to feel guilty if you actually have a happy day around happy people? Our life is not meant to be jumping into a sewer every day of human suffering and somehow feel we can redeem our life by suffering through other people. doesn't work that way. Happy people, healthy people, positive people, creative people, open-minded people, progressive people, that is the future of the community. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us.
Walking through the park, it wasn't quite dark. There was a man sitting on a bench. Out of the crowd, as his head slowly bowed, he just moaned and it made no sense. He just go.
From all over the world, people are listening on every country on the planet and stations all around America. I want to thank you for taking your time to do that and understand that every day we're putting a lot of energy into collecting the best articles, documentaries, information, points of action on social issues and posting it on ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com for you. And if you look at the numbers, they are substantial. What was it last month? 28 million? So we're reaching people. And by the way, that webinar on how to slow down reversing the aging process nastily, you can go up to GaryNoll.com or PRN.FM. It's two Sundays from now, 7 p.m. My guest down in Washington, D.C., it's Snape, S-N-A-P-E?
It's Snape, just like Professor Snape. Gary, Snape. Good to talk to you.
Okay, nice to have you with us, Bill. Bill, we have some issues I'd like you to take your time to go into. Your organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, has now filed two lawsuits against the Trump White House. One is for the administration's violation of the National Environmental Policy Act that requires an assessment of the environmental impact of a construction on public land. And this concerns Trump's wall on the U.S.-Mexican border, which is being steamrolled without any environmental review of the impact it will have. The second lawsuit is against Trump's approval for pushing forward with the Keystone Pipeline, which earlier assessments under Obama showed it would create massive pollution of water resources and worsen climate change and endanger rare species. Now, we're also watching this administration completely gut the Environmental Protection Agency, remove officials and employees, and plan to stack the agency with people from private industry who represent commercial interests gained from destroying the environment and biodiversity. And there's also other radical measures being taken, such as $1.5 billion cut from the Department of Interior, that's 12%, scrubbing executive websites of references to climate change, laying off climate change scientists, opening up streams to mining waste, rewriting the rules for carbon emission regulations, offshore oil drilling, opening up millions of acres and water resources of national parks and national monuments to private oil and commercial interests. And all this is against popular opinion. A March Gallup poll showed 60% of Americans saying that protecting the environment is more urgent than fossil fuel extraction, and less than 30% favor renewal of coal mining. So, Bill, I'd like you to give an overall assessment of Trump's strategy for saving the environment, which he repeatedly states he loves, and where is this all eventually leading in the context of increasing climate change and the further destruction of the environment already underway? The forum is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Gary, and that was a great introduction. And, I would just say as an overview that never, and certainly my lifetime, have we had such a craven and crass president of the United States. The degree to which both he and his administration are tools of larger economic forces is just remarkable. It's almost breathtaking. And of course, it's leading to a lot of the secrecy, which itself leads to more paranoia from the Trump administration, all sorts of contradictions. They can't get anything straight. And I would say, really what these lawsuits are about, and really what I think the public resistance that's going on all over the country is about, is holding people responsible to the rule of law. This is very consciously a country not about the rule of people. We rejected that model 250 years ago. And while we haven't implemented the model perfectly, obviously, over our nation's history, we still align ourselves with the idea that we are a nation of laws. And what we're seeing here is an administration that literally creates facts, literally creates its own reality. And, of course, that's just running into the buzzsaw of the federal courts, which, whether you're a Republican nominee or a Democratic nominee as a judge, you know, they're sworn to uphold the law. And so the two cases that you mentioned, just by way of example, and I should point out that we've actually filed 15 suits in total against the Trump administration since they've taken office. But the two that you mentioned are certainly among the two biggies, and both involve a statute called the National Environmental Policy Act. And the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA for short, is actually the oldest of our modern environmental statutes. It was actually signed by Richard Nixon in 1970 from a Democratic Congress. And it's almost entirely a procedural statute. All it really asks is for federal agencies to seek and use the best information that it has before it. And on both the border wall, which is, you know, an unbelievably ridiculous proposal, and then on the reversal of Keystone, both lawsuits at their essence are saying that the facts and public information that the administration is relying upon are just wrong, and they either need to be supplemented or they need to be the action needs to be changed to accommodate reality. So, and I guess the other theme that is very clear about these 15 lawsuits, at least the 15 that we have filed, is that they really are synonyms and translations for the industries that the Trump administration is serving, whether it is mining minerals, big oil and gas, big ag, pesticides in the chemical industry. All of our lawsuits are aimed over the last 3 months at stopping the Trump administration from literally giving away the public interest, the public trust, to the highest bidder, and at the expense of our public health and at the expense of our democracy. So these cases are all early on. Only a fool litigator predicts any type of victory all the time, but we feel very good that we have good lawsuits, that the laws are strongly stating that the administration is moving in the wrong direction, and it will take a few months more to play out, but we're feeling comfortable that we've established a good defensive bulwark against this insanity.
I appreciate that. It was Maria Curry who said, "Nothing in life is to be feared. It is only to be understood." And I believe a lot of people fear Trump, because it's hard for most people to understand him. Is he just a businessman trying to continue his exploitation of people as if this were simply another business deal? And when you look at it from the environmental perspective, the average American sadly cannot appreciate the enormous cost to our planet due to the extinction of species. They simply do not understand the intricate ecologies of interrelated species that keep natural land vital and resilient. And for the average American who is completely alienated from the wild, the death of species is impersonal, and it's distant, and it's abstract. If I tell you that we're losing 200 species every 24 hours, that's an accurate statement. And you say, well, how many is that overall? Well, that's about 2% per year. We say, that's not too bad. Yeah, but in 10 years, you've lost 20% of all species, and a lot of those were related to each other. So when we frame the economic and social and health costs of the Trump administration's assault on the environment in personal, human, and moral terms, how will it directly endanger their lives and the lives of their families and children and loved ones? Then a more powerful message can be sent. So for a moment, imagine all of our listeners right now are Trump supporters. What would you say to them? Because I feel anyone who really cares about this issue needs to know how to present or argue a strong case for why everything this administration is doing needs to be opposed, and humanitarian and ethical issues should be given in response. Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, that's a very powerful question, and I was fortunate enough to hear the last 10 minutes of your piece before I came on as your guest, and I think it's related to that what you were talking about there. I agree with you that the lack of connections that our current society has, not only with the natural world, you said it very eloquently, but I think with each other, with our own species, the human species, and our seeming hatred of people who we don't know or don't understand, and how clearly Trump has played upon those fears, I think is very much a cultural phenomenon. And I think what we're in the midst of right now, and I think the poll numbers you read out a few minutes ago bear this out, which is I think the American people are onto it. Now, I think, you know, let's be honest, there is about, it seems about a quarter of the country that really does seem right now to be a little whacked out. I think, you know, we still have a large proportion of this country that doesn't believe in evolution still. I mean, we seem to have a portion of this country that will do almost what Trump says. But I think the sort of middle 50% of the country, which is a pretty wide swath of human beings, I think are seeing all of this for what it is, which is the president in this sort of paranoid, selfish way, handing over the keys to our government, to his feudal lords. And we're all supposed to just bow and be happy that we may get some crumbs. And in the midst, and in the meantime, you know, all sorts of damage is going on, and all sorts of checks and balances are being thrown out the window. So, you know, the irony of the current situation may be that perhaps it would have been worse had the other candidate won. You know, perhaps now we're finally unpeeling the scab and unpeeling the wound that this country hasn't talked about. And I see, from my perspective, organizing and communications and collaboration across communities that I've never seen in my adult life, certainly not in my professional life. And it's scary because the threats are so real, but it's inspiring because the connections are so real. So I think we need those more connections. And I think in some ways we just got to do more so. We have to just fight back more and make those connections more. And realize along the way that we may suffer a couple hits, because the bottom line is, the child selfish king rules the roost right now, and it's really all of our responsibilities to keep him in check.
I used to work as a scientist for over 33 years in the Institute of Biology, and for about 10 years I worked with idiot savants. And working with the Trump, you get to work with one part of that equation, and it's not the savant. So I'm concerned, Bill. We saw the demonstrations against the Keystone Pipeline, which Obama eventually rejected, and later the Standing Rock standoff opposing the Dakota Pipeline. Could you explain to us the long-term impact these pipelines have on the immediate environment they're constructed through, and what is the greatest risks they pose to the conservation of our natural resources, but also our health and biodiversity? Because I do not believe, in all honesty, that Donald Trump has the intellectual patience or capacity to be reasoned with. I think he's incapable at this point in his life of any new input that would fundamentally change his reactionary proclivities.
You know, I think you're exactly right on that last point. And I think your recitation of the danger is spot on. And I do think that the big battle right now, the big generational battle that's going on right now, is in terms of the sort of epic moment, is, are we going to install another generation's worth of fossil fuel infrastructure? Are we going to finally say no and go renewable, solar and wind, particularly the way we know we need to? And I agree with you. That battle is far from over or decided. It is made more complicated by the fact that not only Republicans, but some corporate Democrats are a little bit contradictory on this issue. I think one of the things that has occurred with Trump being elected president is that it has rallied people together in a way that wouldn't otherwise occur. But the warlords of the oil and gas industry, you know, their tentacles are deep. And I do think this is a larger a set of issues that actually does go beyond Trump. I mean, Trump is just the most absurd puppet of oil and gas movement. But, you know, you look at the history of Exxon and ExxonMobil, you realize this is a company whose mission is to dominate the world. It is not about being a good citizen. And I you know, that the current president, you know, look who he picked as Secretary of State. This is all a part of the same cabal. And I think it's our job and our challenge right now to finally take the clothes off the emperor.
I believe that you're absolutely right, Bill. And I would go one step further. The latest Think Progress showed from the International Energy Agency just today that renewables have passed coal as the largest source of new electricity worldwide. And that is a big plus, because the cost of solar is coming down, the cost of wind, even a new generation of wind that don't have the big blades, and wave power is on the increase, as is geothermal. So in other countries, more so in the United States, they're getting ahead of this. And I believe that we just have to have more demonstrations, more articles, more documentaries, more public health, more public service announcements. Let people know.
Exactly, Gary. And if I can just interject,
I
agree with you. You know, I totally agree with you. And I'm just going to add that there are opportunities to implement these policies and these real actions at the state level. You know, that is not, even though we obviously have to keep our eye on the federal ball, that's obviously the big governmental actor. A lot of state governments not just California moving this direction anyway. And, you know, we might be able to just, we the people, do it anyway, and the federal government will have to get out of the way. So I hear you on the continued strong efforts to keep the federal government in line. That's why we have 15 lawsuits. But I think there might be some opportunities at the state level, both in Republican states and Democratic states, to do the things you're talking about.
Final question. Last month, when Trump said he would commit to protecting our natural resources and parks, he donated his first quarterly salary, which I believe is $78,000, to the National Park Service as proof of his commitment to the environment. And it was shameful, and in my opinion, an utter disgrace, because, in fact, this money is designed solely for the preservation of historic national battlefields. And then separately, does a full frontal assault with an executive order to attack Teddy Roosevelt's Antiquities Act of 1906, which protects our national parks and national monuments. And I assume this will deeply affect Native American lands as well. What are Trump's specific intentions with our public lands, and why should we all be deeply concerned?
Well, his executive order on the Antiquities Act on the public lands of the United States was the most retrograde, the most anti-environmental, the worst environmental public lands action in American history. He has put on the table over 1 billion acres of protected areas that now could fall under the knife of his special oil and gas mining and big chemical interests. And it is a huge concern. What's actually happening now is that the Secretary of Interior, a guy by the name of Ryan Zinke, who's also sort of a bad character, is supposedly looking over these proposals from various interests to redo these designations or get rid of them. But it's clearly a setup. It's clearly something that the Trump administration is currying favor with. And again, our answer is we'll see you in court. They have no authority to do this. The Antiquities Act gives the president the authority to, previous presidents, the authority to make these designations. Trump does not get to, with his crayons, X them out.
I really appreciate all the good work, Bill, that you're doing, and as senior counsel for the Center for Biological Diversity. And the website is biologicaldiversity.org. My guest is Bill Snape, S-N-A-P-E, from Washington, D.C. Bill, I look forward to our next conversation, and we will continue to support your efforts.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
I'm Gary Nall, and we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
You better stop.